You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Good morning. Welcome. It is a delight to be here with you this morning. Today marks the beginning of a 10-part series that we're going to be doing in the Dean's class on the Nicene Creed. Some of you may or may not know, but you will shortly, that we are in the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. Not necessarily the actual creed as we have it, but the Council of Nicaea occurred 1700 years ago. And we thought we'd take that occasion to have a series talking about the Nicene Creed. And we're going to be having 10 different individuals from the Advent who will be teaching in this series, so you're going to get a variety of voices. But it'll almost run every Sunday by Sunday, apart from a couple of Sundays, but it'll run Sunday by Sunday till about mid-August. Is that correct, Gil? So you'll even hear Gil gets the final word. But the first word, he gets the amen of the creed. The first word, the introduction, is Professor Gerald Bray. Gerald, I think if Gerald had been alive in 325, he would have been invited to the council. That's my opinion, but I hold to that. Gerald is probably well known to many of you. I don't need to introduce him. But he is a superb historian, professor. I know that you're going to appreciate his introduction to the creed itself. So bless you, Gerald, and bless all of you as we embark on this 10-part journey through the Nicene Creed.
I can clip that on.
Right.
Great.
Yeah, that's about all right. Is that all right? Can you hear me? Good. Well, thank you, Dean, for that introduction. I should perhaps say that some of my students think I was alive in 325, you know. But anyway, anything before the invention of the internet, you know, is ancient history as far as they're concerned. Well, it's lovely to be with you. I've got a bit of a cold, so if I start coughing, I've got some water underneath here, so I apologize for that in advance. I've been asked to introduce this series on what we call the Nicene Creed. And the first thing I need to say, I think, is that this creed is not what you might think it is. All right? If I write a book today and publish it, but in fact I've plagiarized it from somebody else, I'd be in serious trouble, you know. You can't pass off the work of other people as your own and get away with it. But in the ancient world, people thought differently from that. And the titles that we give to these documents today are titles that say something different. They're not talking about the author of the text, but about the beliefs that the people who are associated with these texts were supposed to have or to have had and which have been maintained for posterity. So to understand this, we have to start with what we call today the Apostles' Creed. The Apostles' Creed you may be familiar with because we say it at morning and evening prayer. If you were in morning prayer this morning, you would have said it today, was not written by the apostles, all right? That's the first thing. In fact, at the time of when the Nicene Creed appeared, there was no Apostles' Creed as we know it today. There were a number of documents or creedal statements which resemble the Apostles' Creed. If I haven't got them all with me this morning, but you know, there are several hundred different varieties of it. If you looked at it, at them, you would see a resemblance. There's a kind of family resemblance among them. But they weren't written by a particular person or a particular group. They were introduced in different local churches, at the time of baptism. People, when they were came for baptism, they had to confess their faith, and they would be asked questions. Do you believe in God the Father? Do you believe in God the Son? Do you believe in God the Holy Spirit? And the answers which they gave to those questions were the basis, the groundwork of what we now think of as the creeds. All right, and gradually, as time went on, these became more common. They were used more widely in different congregations. And as the church grew, of course, like anything else, it becomes more institutionalized, perhaps you might say more bureaucratic in a way. What had been several different creeds, or slightly different creeds, were kind of homogenized and put together. And the creed that we today say is the Apostles' Creed actually appears for the first time in the 8th century. I think it can be dated to something like the year 724. And the only reason we use it today is because Charlemagne, the great emperor Charlemagne, picked it up and introduced it into the liturgy of the church at that time, around the year 800. All right, but of course there's a tradition of similar things which had been in existence for many centuries. And it's important to understand this because the Nicene Creed comes out of that. It's different from the Apostles' Creed because it didn't sort of have many different varieties in different churches. It was, in fact, promulgated, that is, proclaimed at church councils, of which the First Council of Nicaea is the one that we're celebrating this year. So this was the case. And what they did, apparently, was adapt some of these baptismal creeds, you know, the creeds that were the origin of the Apostles' Creed, for a collective statement of faith. You can see this because in the traditional texts, instead of "I believe in God the Father Almighty," etc., it starts off, "We believe in God the Father Almighty." Now, in the course of adaptation for our liturgies today, that "we" generally has been dropped, or at least has been made to conform with "I." So we might say "I" today, but that's because of a later editorial adjustment, if you like, to make it personal to the individual. But it was originally in the form of "we," because it was a collective statement of a council of the church at that time. Now, the next question is, which council of the church actually proclaimed this? Well, there was a council of the church which was held in Nicaea. Nicaea is a city not very far away from Istanbul, Constantinople, as it would have been. And it was there that this council was held in the year 325, which is why we're celebrating 1700 years now. The creed that council adopted is the one on the left of the handout that I have given you. And it is usually abbreviated as N. That is to say, if you read books about it, you know, rather than repeating Council of Nicaea all the time, they abbreviate it to N. So that I may do that as well. If you look at this, you'll see that some of the lines under N are in italics, And these are the lines which were not carried over, shall we say. They're not in the text on the right, all right, for whatever reason. We'll look at that in a minute. The text on the right, which I have called C, well, I haven't done this. This is the scholarly world generally refers to it as C, is generally associated with another church council, which was held in Constantinople in the year 381. In other words, a generation and a half later. I put a question mark next to this for several reasons. One, because the acts of the council, the minutes that were taken and, you know, the reports that were made, do not in fact contain this creed. Which said, well, why not? You know, if they proclaimed it at the council, why isn't it in the minutes? Well, those of you who take minutes of meetings may have various suggestions as to why the most important things don't actually get into them. But there we are. It didn't happen. The first definite reference we have to it actually comes from 70 years later, in the year 451, at another council which was held in a place called Chalcedon. Chalcedon is a suburb of Constantinople on the Asian side. You know, Constantinople, Istanbul is on the boundary between Europe and Asia. The main city is in Europe on the European side. And Chalcedon is on the other side, and you cross over. So it's really quite near that. That we do know, you know, that this creed was proclaimed there, for sure. And it was there that it was said that it was the creed of the First Council of Constantinople that had been held in 381, 70 years before. The difficulty, of course, is nobody who was there in 451 had been there in 381. I mean, there might have been a few people who were alive in 381, but 70 years is rather a long time. And so the people who might have known, might have been eyewitnesses, were all dead by then. So we don't really know for sure whether that's correct or not. It's complicated even further. I'm sorry, I hope this isn't, you know, too difficult for you to master. By yet another council, which was held in Ephesus 20 years before Chalcedon. In other words, in the year 431, which is only 50 years after the previous one. And there may have been a couple of people in Ephesus in 381 who were old enough to remember the earlier one. That's possible. What the Council of Ephesus said, and we have this in the minutes, is that they confessed the faith of Nicaea. What we don't know is whether that was N or C, because the actual creed itself is not reproduced in the records. You see, just a mention of it, but it's put in such a vague way that nobody really knows where it came from. I would think that most students of the subject now believe that C appeared shortly after the First Council of Constantinople in 381. In other words, the council itself seems to have appointed a committee or something, you know, go away and draw this up, and that's what they did. That's what people seem to think. But, as I say, there's no absolute proof of that, all right? So do be careful, because people run around talking about the Nicene Creed and so on, without going into all these details. But you have it in front of you, you know, evidence that things are not as simple as they look. If you look at the paper that I've given you, you'll see that on the right-hand side, some of the text is in bold type. This is because those things were added. They are not in the in N, all right? They are things which at some point came later. The question is, did the people who wrote C, did they take N? They must have known about N. Did they take N and revise it? Or did they base it on some other version of what we would now call the Apostles' Creed and basically produce it independently? And the general belief, and I say this is a general belief, is that it's this second thing that they did, that they didn't in fact touch N, they left N alone, and took another document, creedal form, which was similar, of course, you can see, similar to N, but basically worked on that from scratch. Why do we say this? Well, because the text in italics in N, you have to explain why those words were dropped. You know, if N was revised by being extended, but being added to, that would be understandable. You know, we wouldn't have this problem. But you have to say, well, they didn't just do that. They dropped things from N, if that's what they did. You see, that's how they started. And we look at what's missing in C, and we say to ourselves, well, there doesn't seem to be any very good reason why they should have dropped that. So they probably didn't start with that. They started with something else, all right? Does it make a difference to us today? Not really. Because when we look at the substance of what they're saying, it's basically the same, you know, in both cases. The overall confession is the same. It's just the form that it takes. Now, how did this come about? Why did it happen like this? Until the year 313, which is 12 years before the First Council of Nicaea, Christianity in the Roman Empire was illegal. Persecution was not universal all the time. It was sporadic. You know, every once in a while, some emperor would get on his high horse and say the Christians are being a nuisance and, you know, we'll have to persecute them. It was very useful because Christians were kind of like communists today. Not that anybody really understood what they were, but when you had to blame somebody for something, that was a useful way of doing it, you know. And so that happened from time to time. But of course, as so often happens when you do that, persecution has the opposite effect. And we've seen this in our own day. I mean, when the missionaries were thrown out of China in 1950, there were apparently something like a million Christians in China. I mean, which for a country like that, it's actually a very small number. Today, there are at least 130 million Christians, maybe more, virtually all of whom have become Christians since the expulsion of the missionaries, some of whom have suffered quite considerable persecution and so on. Why? Because people say, well, these people are suffering for their beliefs, there must be something to it. You know, I mean, how many people are actually going to go to their death for believing in something that they know isn't true? You know, even if you want it to be true, even if you think it's true. I mean, there are some people who believe in Mickey Mouse, but are they going to die for him? I don't think so. Better be careful about saying this, because some of you may say, oh, I would, but I don't know that you would really, all right? So persecution is, as I say, has an opposite effect. But in the year 313, the Emperor Constantine decided, if you can't beat them, not exactly join them. He didn't become a Christian himself at this point, but tolerate them, give them legal status. You know, in other words, this is the attitude, of course, that people today take, or at least the state takes, to things like cannabis. You know, if you can't eliminate it, make it legal, and see if you can control it in some way or other. And so that's what happened in the year 313. But at that time, the Emperor Constantine did not rule the entire Roman Empire. There were other emperors, rivals, that he had to defeat. And it took him just over 10 years to do that. But in the year 324, he finally defeated the last of his rivals and became the sole ruler of the empire, of the Roman Empire. And he decided at this point that he would call a council of the church together to get them to decide what a Christian is. You see, it's all very well to say Christianity is legalized, but how do you define it? Who is a Christian and who isn't? You know, how do you know who these people are? And this was the purpose of the council which he summoned. Originally, he summoned it elsewhere, to a city which, well, it's modern Ankara, the capital of Turkey today. But somewhere in the process, he decided to change the venue, and it ended up in Nicaea. The church authorities, such as they were, did not ask for that. It wasn't their idea to have a council put together. Today, we call the First Council of Nicaea the first of the ecumenical councils. But the word ecumenical was used in ancient times to refer to the Roman Empire. You see, in Greek or in Latin, there wasn't a word for Roman Empire. I mean, how are you going to say this? They didn't have a word. So what did they call it? They called it the Oikoumene, which means in Greek, the inhabited world, the civilized world. People who didn't live in the Roman Empire were barbarians and called that. You know, they didn't believe in political correctness back in those days, and so the word ecumenical basically should be translated as imperial. You see, something that refers to the empire itself, and it was called by Constantine with that purpose in view. The leading church authorities at the time panicked, because this wasn't what they wanted at all. Most of them had suffered persecution, because remember, it's only a decade or so, you know, that Christianity had been legalized. And so they start wondering, well, you know, what's this man playing at? Does he want to control us? Does he want to you know, do something that we don't particularly want? But they were in a bind. You know, what do you do when somebody does something like this? So they called a council of their own, which met in Antioch, the city of Antioch in Syria, the year before. And this was their, you know, their thing. They organized this. And they kind of worked out the strategy that they were going to adopt when they went to Nicaea. So that what happened at Nicaea was actually worked out in advance by church leaders who said, well, you know, this is the program we're going to present, this will stick together, and if the emperor wants us to make a decision, this is what we're going to decide, more or less. All right? The emperor, as I said, at this point, did not join the church. Now, people have written books, was he a Christian, was he not a Christian? Well, he was a politician. And I don't have to tell you about politicians and their relationship to faith, other people's faith. There is much into other people's faith as the votes require. We know this. And this was true for him as well. You know, these are the people who are going to back me, so of course I go along with them. But going along with them did mean certain things. For example, he gave special tax exemptions to the churches and to the clergy. And these have survived to varying degrees to the present time. And for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason churches don't sort of shout loud and say, well, you know, we ought to pay tax. Nobody does that for some reason. I don't know why. But anyhow, Constantine, you know, gave them tax benefits. That's one thing. He also decreed that Sunday should be a day of rest. But again, he was clever about this because, of course, it was the day of resurrection, so it was a Christian Sabbath. But it was also in pagan worship the day of the sun, as indeed the name that we still use for it today indicates. And sun worship was quite a common thing in the ancient world. So it kind of played on both sides, all right, this. Constantine was eventually baptized, but only on his deathbed, which was in 337. Now again, you know, was he a believer all along and just deferring this till he died? Or was he a late convert? We don't know, you know, and there's no point speculating about his personal beliefs, which in a way don't really matter for us. You know, I mean, it matters to him, of course, but for us is a different thing. So we can't really say too much about that. But what it did mean at the Council of Nicaea was that he could not take part in it because he wasn't a member of the church. So the decisions that were taken there were not his. In fact, I think he did go to the opening sessions of the council and made a speech, you know, welcoming people there and so on. He didn't take part in any of the discussions or deliberations at all. Who did? Well, they were the bishops of the different churches who were summoned to the council. Now, in those days, bishops were rather different from what they are now, on the whole. Modern bishops have a diocese and, you know, have several churches to look after, and you may never meet them or see them. Certainly not on a daily basis. But in the early church, the bishop was much closer to what we would today call the head pastor of a congregation. All right. So the dean of the Advent would be the bishop and would be somebody that you actually knew, would have dealings with on a regular basis. The reason I'm saying this is that the bishops who gathered at Nicaea were much closer to their people than the average modern bishop is. I mean, I don't know about you, but I could walk past the Bishop of Alabama in the street and not recognize her at all. I just wouldn't know. And that's not a criticism, it's just a fact. I mean, I don't know who these people are particularly. But I couldn't walk past the dean of the cathedral and not recognize him, because he's closer, closer to us. We see him on a more regular basis. So when we talk about the bishops going to Nicaea, it's this kind of person we have to think about. People who were actually deeply involved in local congregations, who had the pulse, of what was going on, and who had the ability to preach it when they went back home. They were actually talking to congregations, to real people, and putting it across to them. So that's an important point to bear in mind. Having said that, it is said that there were 318 bishops who went to the council and who signed the creed. We don't know whether that's true or not. The lists that we have lists of people who were there, but they tend to be about 250, something like that. We can't really say too much about this because maybe there were 318, other people, but their names haven't been preserved one way or the other. But even if there were 318, this was still a minority of the churches that were in existence at that time. Because if you think all across the Roman Empire, I don't know how many churches there would have been, but probably in the thousands, because you'd have every town, every village, everywhere would have a church, or most places would have a church. And they didn't go to the council. Why didn't they go to the council? Well, it's a long way to go. You have to remember people basically had to go on foot or on horseback or by boat, and that would take forever. It wasn't an easy thing to do. So it was a minority of people, of the people who could have gone, who actually went. But having said that, they were representative. In other words, the majority of people accepted what was done there. You see, they said, yes, this is what we agree to. And so the decisions that were taken at that time generally passed into the church as a whole, all right? So even though not everybody who could have gone actually went, nevertheless, the impact was much greater, than just the people who were actually there, all right? So that's an important thing. Now, having said that, the church at the time in 325 was in crisis for other reasons, all right? Constantine, when he legalized Christianity, really didn't know what Christianity was all about. Well, he had some idea, I suppose, but he didn't know, all the internal tensions and difficulties that there were in different places. In some places, there were people in the church who objected to being legally recognized because they felt, well, legal recognition, it's only happening because of some compromise that the church is making with the state. And they don't want compromise. You know, they didn't necessarily know what the compromise was, but they figured if the emperor is suddenly on our side, there's something wrong. And there's something wrong with us. You know, we're not doing the right thing, so we're not going along with this. All right, well, that's understandable. Those people go off on one side. But much more difficult to deal with were people within the church who had different theological opinions. And the main problem at this time was a heresy which has come down to us under the name of Arianism, supposedly developed by a priest in Alexandria by the name of Arius, who, again, supposedly in the year 318 began to preach in Alexandria his own doctrine, which was regarded as heretical. Well, think about this. The year 318. Christianity was already legalized in the parts of the Roman Empire that the Emperor Constantine controlled. But Alexandria, where Arius was preaching, was not one of those places. So in Alexandria, when Arius was preaching in 318, the church was still suffering persecution, or at least liable to suffer persecution. It was only 6 years later, when Constantine conquered it, that danger was removed. But of course, Arius and his teaching were still there, and the condemnation was still there. So this was a problem. But Constantine, I don't know, I mean, he either didn't know about it, or what he knew about it was very vague. You know, somebody over there is having a theological argument, but we'll sort that out, it doesn't really matter. But unfortunately, it did matter. Arianism as a heresy is extremely difficult to pin down because it comes in many different varieties. Now again, we're familiar with this, you know. I mean, I work in a what is essentially a Baptist institution, but after 32 years, I still wonder who is a Baptist. I mean, all Baptists are different. Have you ever noticed this? There's something called the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, and I said that must be very small. You know, they don't cooperate. But anyhow, leave that to one side. Arianism is a bit like this. You see, everybody had their own variation on it. And so it's hard to pin it down. You see, what's wrong with it? What was the heresy itself? Well, the basic heresy was, and this will be discussed later on during this course, is that Jesus Christ is not fully God in the same way that the Father is God. Now, that is not Orthodox Christian teaching, because we teach that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the three persons of the Trinity, are equal, they're co-equal. It's not the official teaching of the church, but it is the belief of a great many church members. Now, you may be horrified to hear this, but you shouldn't really be, because if I ask you the question, is Jesus Christ God? You might scratch your head for a minute and say, well, he's the Son of God. But that's somehow different from being just God. And so, although you don't realize it, you are actually an Arian. you see, of some description. But as I say, since anyone can be an Aryan of their own kind, it's very hard to pin you down on this. So I'm not here to drive you out of the church. But just simply to point out that it's a very easy heresy to fall into because it sounds right. You see, the best heresies are 90% right. It's the other 10% that you've got to watch because that sort of, you know, skews the whole picture. You see what I mean? If you stand up and just lie to somebody 100%, you might get away with it for a while, but you're not going to get away with it for very long. If you really want to throw people off, tell them something that's more or less true, but not quite. You know, in other words, it's the devil is in the detail. Or read the small print, as we might say today. You know how it is. You sign the paper and then discover that what you think you signed is not what you signed at all. But that's, you have to have a lawyer to tell you that. And it costs you a lot of money by the time you find out. This is what Arianism was like, all right? And it was against this background that the Council of Nicaea and indeed the Creed was composed. It was to try to say in as clear a way as possible that God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit are three persons in the one God. All right? And it was to get that right, to find the right way to say it, that is really the history behind the development of the Creed and the source of the difference between N on the one hand and C. Because however N and C are related, N is more like a first attempt to do this, whereas C is a much more sophisticated and developed expression of the same idea, all right? And it's C that is the creed that we use today in the church, all right? That's our Nicene Creed. I've got to stop there. I've run out of my time, but please, if you can, keep these things because for the next several weeks, I'm sure whoever's in charge will ensure that copies are made because you'll want to refer back to this as you go through in detail each of the individual sentences and clauses. Okay? But I've tried to give you an introduction to the study as a whole. And I look forward to seeing the results in 2 or 3 months' time. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.